This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're joined by a lawyer and former state senator. He served a dozen years in the Louisiana legislature, Dan Clater, who, of course, also ran for district attorney at one point, losing a tough race to Hiller Moore, and he lost to Garrett Graves as well for Congress back in the year of 2014. But I know of nobody who's more Baton Rouge than Dan Clater, an old line family with a strong business perspective in this community, and a guy who grew up here. Grew up on Park Boulevard, didn't you?
No, I grew up on Highland Road. My grandparents lived on Park Boulevard.
Okay. And you went to Lehigh, where you were a champion, played with some great players. And Dan was the leading tackler, I believe, as a linebacker at Lehigh.
Only because they were running away from Albert Richardson, Leonard Smith, and Eugene Daniels.
All of those players were top flight. Albert Richardson still the leading tackler in the history of LSU, and Daniel and Leonard Smith both played in the NFL. So, yeah, and played well at the highest level. So Dan's got quite a pedigree, and a listener's already asked, since I mentioned Lehigh, what about the name change? Are you okay with that?
Oh, you know, it's times change. You know, they shorten it from Robert E. Lee to Lee, and then Liberty, and times change, and we have to change with it.
You don't sound all that enthused about it, though.
I am not a black person in America, so I don't always have the perspective that I need, and so that's important for the community, and that's happened, and there you go.
What about the change in the city over the last 25 years? And, of course, there have been social changes. It's now a blue city. It was once a red city, politically we're talking. But we have lots of problems. But amid that, we've had some great success stories, notably downtown. Dan Clater, I'm sure when you were growing up as a kid, downtown was flourishing, and then it wasn't for a very long time, a few decades or more. And now it's back. What's your perception?
When they started, the government started taking over different buildings downtown and doing their building process. Our bookstore was downtown from 1926 to 1968, and then we moved to the suburbs like everyone else. But as a kid, I used to run around downtown and go to the Hatter's shop and go to the camera shop, and go to the Piccadilly, go hang out at the Capitol and see what those old men were up to. But, you know, we're going back, and not only is downtown making a resurgence, but that type of city. You look at River Ranch, you look at Willow Grove, you look at Americana. That's what people want. They want to be able to walk to dinner and do that type of thing. So I'm very pleased for downtown, happy for it.
Terry Elmore says, ask Dan about old-time Baton Rouge bars. I'm sure you've been to a few of those, a few dives along the way.
Yeah, and, you know, the Brusos were our tenants with the catering. Had great live music there for a long time. And then when the shopping center burnt down in 2010, that was the end of the catering. The Bruso brothers weren't running it at that time, but I would tend bar at Uncle Earl's, and you would see everybody going into the place next door to catch great acts like David Crosby and whatnot. So,
yeah,
I want to say the Sex Pistols were actually
they
there.
They were. Sting. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of people right down the shopping center from you. And another listener notes that rumor has it that at one point 30 or so years ago that Coach O had a fistic encounter that was memorable at Clater's. Not at Clater's, but at
the catering.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if people change, that's where we started. Times change. Or I might have had a fistic encounter or two myself along the way. And
well,
at
Lord
least
knows,
my folks would
Lord
say I turned
I
out
have.
All right.
Lord knows I have, but Coach O has apparently matured as he's gotten older, as most people do.
Yeah, well, and alcohol always seems to have a little bit to do with fistic encounters, too.
And sometimes it doesn't even take alcohol.
No, that's true.
In this case, I think he just wanted his credit card back. He was mad he couldn't get his credit card back, so one thing led to another, and boom. I think a headbutt might have been involved as well.
Ouch.
Yeah. But anyway, speaking of Uncle Earl's, I think the owner of Uncle Earl's is Jordan Piazza, isn't he?
At this time, yeah. And back in the day, it was Mac Brusso.
And he's running for mayor of Baton Rouge.
He is. He's a tenant of ours and been a good tenant for many years. My younger brother, John, handles the real estate side of things. So we've had a good relationship with him. But I know he's much more than a bar owner. He's been active in a lot of other things, as I understand it.
Well, let's start on the Republican side of the mayoral equation. We've got three major candidates from the GOP, Piazza being one, and I think I consider him in that realm as a major candidate, Steve Carter, and Matt Watson, who will be with us on Friday. How do you view that side of the spectrum as we approach November 3rd?
Yeah, you know, I think everybody was surprised to see Carter go into the race, but I'm sure he had good reason and wanted to present himself on that. Where I think that changed the makeup as far as what you would expect to turn out. So as far as how I think the turnout will be, and I don't have any polling to prove it, but I think Steve is probably the leader in that group. And then I would guess Matt and Piazza are about the same, but I see Piazza as kind of a dark horse spoiler in that, as you know, when good or bad, when you have no record to run on for having voted for this or that, you're very virgin as far as that's concerned, and they don't have any prior legislation to stick up your nose one way or another. So I see it, Carter, Piazza, Watson, myself.
Now, Carter in the past has been backed by Lane Grigsby, who you had a collision with in the previous race involving Steve Carter and Franklin Foyle. Grigsby, now that Tara Wicker has been removed from the race, will probably be with Carter. Now, Steve Carter is, of course, a fine fellow. You two, you were in studio. But can you support somebody who is being supported by Lane Grigsby?
Well, I can. You know, everybody has their own choice on who they support. But Mr. Grigsby and I have been together on things and apart on things, but I don't let his opinion dictate where mine has to be. And I think most people, with presented with information they need to make a decision, can make their own decision and prefer to make their own decisions.
Okay. 877-217-5757. Before we go to the phones, what about the Democratic side? You've got Sharon Weston Broome, the incumbent, being opposed by a fellow Democrat, Denise Marcel. Your thoughts about that side of the ledger?
Well, Sharon and I are friends. Same thing as kind of Mr. Grigsby. She and I have been on the same page on a lot of things and opposed on some. We were obviously far apart on the transition of the St. George district, but then in the same session, I was helping her with some of the law enforcement issues that were going on within the city. So as a person, I like Sharon, and she and I are friends. I also like Denise. I think, though, that there's a possibility that Denise might edge out Sharon within the African-American community. Again, I don't have polling that I'm looking at. That's just bit of a gut feel that I have there. So on the Democratic side, I wouldn't be totally shocked to see Denise perform a lot better than folks are expecting.
All right. But if there is a runoff, and there probably will be, the conventional wisdom is that Sharon Weston Broome will be in a runoff with somebody, and it could be Denise. Here's Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, gentlemen. And Mr. Clater, I just want to thank you and your family for you know, how much you've been part of Baton Rouge's history and the whole law profession as well. My question to you is, what's your position on Carl Ardoin's suppression of the vote by, you have to get a doctor's note if you want to get a mail-in ballot?
What do you think of the plan that Secretary Ardoin has delivered? Is it fair?
Well, I think it could be better. Donna Britt, Mark Ballard's wife, in that piece that they ran on how difficult it is for her to vote, is persuasive, where my friends are getting older now, and a lot of them have difficulty having an opportunity to vote. So at the same time, nobody wants illegal or improper votes. So you have to have the appropriate safeguards on it, but I think that plan could be improved upon.
Here's a long email. I don't think I'm going to be able to read it all, but Terry Elmore following up on downtown Baton Rouge, he says, around 1990, I traveled from Denver to Baton Rouge. The company I worked for had a contract with the state. Lucky me, there was a decrepit motel called the General Lafayette, 3rd and Main Street, he says, and I got to stay there. That was way before all the H's moved downtown, Hyatt, Hilton, Holiday Inn. Underneath the General on Main Street, down a flight of disgruntled concrete steps lay, the thirsty tiger. It says if you were adventurous, you could travel to Alligator Bayou. Hell, I hadn't been in Baton Rouge for 24 hours. I went to Po' Boy Lloyd's at 6, ordered a scrambled egg breakfast with a Budweiser. I told Fred Taylor, the owner, this is my morning bar. I swung around Bates and Thigpen on 3rd Street. Willie Bates, now deceased, was the owner, treated me like a king, set me up with some new duds that I could appropriately meet, so I could meet the president of the Senate, whom Willie knew, and then proceeded to take me on a tour of some of downtown's finest buildings. Jim, I was very impressed. I think Willie was sort of an unofficial architectural historian, and he goes on from there about the Mirror Lounge, a bar that was famous downtown. And Baton Rouge, even in the midst of despair, had some character, Dan Clater, the downtown area.
Yeah, oh, it did. We had our high school graduation party at the Hilton up there at the top. Would let a bunch of 17-year-olds in at that time.
We're going to spend a few more minutes with Dan Clater and then from the fabulous poet Joshua Bennett back after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. A few more minutes with Senator Dan Clater, now a former member of the state legislature. Spent a dozen years. He was term limited. He's now practicing law, as he's done for many years. Former prosecutor, worked for Harry Connick in New Orleans, 877-217-5757. And we're about to go to Joshua Bennett, one of the remarkable young poets in American life. His latest work is an amazing collection of poems. It's called Ode. But before we go there, a few questions from listeners that I'll pass along to Dan in our remaining moments. Listener, this is Alex in Port Allen saying, are you surprised that both Hiller Moore and Tony Clayton were elected to six-year terms as DA without opposition in East Baton Rouge and West Baton Rouge parishes?
Not at all. Hiller Moore's doing a great job. I thank him every time I see him for whipping me very handily when we ran. That's a tough, tough job, and he does a great job with it. And Tony is a spectacular prosecutor, and we know he does a good job at that. He'll have to make a bit of a jump to the management side of things, but I believe that he's managed big, complex litigation and a law office, so it really shouldn't be any different. I expect he'll do an outstanding job as well.
And another question from a listener is about, we were speaking of downtown Baton Rouge, and you grew up here. I didn't. You're old enough to remember the three downtown movie theaters. Did you go to those theaters?
Paramount, the Gordon, and the Hart. The Paramount was great. I was very disappointed when they tore it down, and they had a double seat in it about halfway down the row that when you came in with your friends, you would try to jump in there as quickly as you could so that you can have the big fine seat. And then I think you know, remember, Jim, that my dad was 6'7", so whenever I went to the movies with him, there would always be a bunch of moaning and groaning when we sat down and people getting up and moving because he blocked their view. But those were great theaters. I saw a lot of Clint Eastwood movies downtown.
Yeah, what was your fave?
On the Clint Eastwood?
Yeah.
The Good and the Bad and the Ugly. They were all pretty good. I wasn't too crazy about the Every Which Way But Loose type of things. And Play Misty for me was kind of a weird one, but hey.
Oh, that's a great film.
Yeah.
That was his first directing performance, too. But certainly chilling for anybody who's been in radio. But thank you. Appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you.
See you soon, Dan Clater.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. We're joined now by by Joshua Bennett. And, I think we just lost Joshua. So I don't know if Dan disconnected him or if I did, but at any rate, we'll hopefully get him back. And he is a remarkable young poet, and he's also a professor of English at Dartmouth University, English and Creative Writing, a graduate of Princeton, and hopefully we will make contact with him, and sometimes that's the way it goes. So I'm tap dancing until we get him back, and Matt tells me that we're very close to accomplishing just that. So Joshua Bennett, his book is Ode, and he is a gentleman that we're going to hear a lot from in the years to come, because he is getting, and I'm putting it mildly, rave reviews for his work, and you're going to have to pull him up. So there we go. Joshua Bennett, sorry about the disconnect, but we've got you now. And according to Dissent magazine, Joshua is, quote, one of the most impressive voices in poetry today, quietly building a reputation as one of the brightest intellectual and political thinkers of a new generation. His new collection is Ode, perfectly melding his apt social and political commentary with the warmth and familiarity of the human experience. And when you're doing poetry and you're also mixing in the issues of the day, that's not an easy thing to accomplish. How have you been able to do it?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think I always just try to start with the personal and then expand to the universal from there. My father is a Vietnam veteran. He also integrated his high school in Alabama. And I think I was just someone who was raised to see the personal history of my family as tied to larger historical forces. So for me, I'm just always aiming at truth and hoping it resonates with someone, no matter what their background is or what their story might be.
Well, you certainly don't shy away from America's past brutality, which is now in the news. And as we know, the past is also often a prologue to the present. And what do you make of what's going on in our world right now?
I mean, in so many ways, tragically, right? I see it as sort of repetition, right, of forces that I've seen at least throughout my entire life. So I'm from New York originally, and you know, I first learned the name Amadou Diallo when I was 11 years old. You know, and when I went to college, a man named Sean Bell was shot by the NYPD 50 times on his wedding night, right? So especially as it pertains to these sort of public killings of citizens by police, that has been the sort of background to my life, you know, to the trajectory of my life. And I think the fact that, you know, everyone has a camera on their phone now means that is being forced in front of us in a different way. But it's a longstanding truth of American life, right, that what is some people's safety and security is other people's terror. And I think until we can tell the truth about that, nothing will change.
You have noted, Joshua, that everything in our country's dominant cultural frame tells us that blackness is deficient. Could you expound on that?
Wow, that was well-researched. Yeah, I mean, so there's this classic scene in the autobiography of Malcolm X, right, where Malcolm is going through the dictionary and he sees that sort of all the synonyms for black are negative, right? Even the word denigration itself, if you look in the etymology, right, it means to blacken. And so part of what I'm trying to articulate in this book, part of why it's called Ode, right, is a play on, of course, the poems, right, O-D-E, right, poems of celebration. But it's also trying to think about how we can repair our relationships to spaces, to people, to objects in black culture that we have been taught are sites of shame. So there are poems in here, for instance, about do-rags or about high-top fades, but also there's a poem about ankle weights. And for those of you out there who don't know what ankle weights are, you know, I imagine myself as a middle school hooper, right? And so I wore ankle weights every single day. And though I think clearly that's unhealthy, right, on some level. But looking back, I actually really admire that, the kind of discipline that took for me and the other black boys with whom I came of age. Even though we eventually were sort of ashamed of that and thought it was silly, I've come to admire it now as a writer and thinker and teacher. So, again, yeah, I think the kind of violence we see against black people in the public sphere, the kind of stereotypical images we see circulating, are tied to these larger symbolic ideas that we all inherit. And I think that we all internalize to differing degrees, right? And that's the kind of soul work, the kind of work at the level of the imagination that we'll all have to do to get out of this.
You say your work is largely a reflection of the life of your father. You noted his Vietnam service. He served in Vietnam, and by the way, Bill Clinton didn't, George Bush didn't, Donald Trump didn't, and Joe Biden didn't, and they were all of Vietnam age, and yet your father did, and I suspect he was treated much differently than they were. Is this an unfortunate reality that we have not focused upon because we just don't like unpleasant things?
Yeah, I mean, my father enlisted in part because the recruiter told him that they wouldn't take two sons from the same family. You know, and his younger brother, my uncle, wanted to go to Vietnam. And my father enlisted to save his little brother's life, right? And there, you know, he experienced, of course, right, a kind of mind-shattering violence, right? My father came back. He was diagnosed with PTSD and of course, you know, carried that trauma in his body in a certain sort of way. And of course, came back again to a country where he was not treated as a hero, right, where he didn't even feel comfortable pursuing his VA benefits for much of my life because of his memories of that war and what it did to him and the way he was treated when he got back. And so, yeah, I mean, that has had a major impact on me and my life in a number of different ways. One, of course, that critique of American imperialism is always at the forefront of my mind. But also I think about the moral courage it takes for a 17-year-old boy to risk his life that way. And to think that it is no small price for him to lay down his life for his little brother. And I think I aspire toward that courage every day. And it's one of the great lessons my father's given me.
And you say you worked 40 years for the Postal Service.
Yes, indeed. 40 years.
That's quite
10-hour shifts. It is.
Well, when you see and hear the Postal Service being harangued, what do you think?
It's a tragedy. Right? It's part of an ongoing assault on the infrastructure that's made it possible for people like my parents to enter the working class and the middle class. Right? My parents were able to buy a home because my father was a veteran, right? And they were able to make those mortgage payments because they worked in the post office. Right? The post office was where they fell in love. And I used to, you know, as a young writer of about 5 or 6 years old, I remember thinking of how proud I was of my dad being a mail handler, because anyone that got a love letter in the mail, that got a scholarship, you know, my father was a part of that, process. There was something magical to me about the mail. And so seeing now the sort of public talking points about the Postal Service as insufficient or as, you know, poorly run, is not just to me historically ridiculous, but it's so painful that kind of denigration of everyday working people has become commonplace. You know, it's quite heartbreaking to see.
We're hearing the voice of Joshua Bennett. Dr. Bennett is a name to remember, received his PhD in English from Princeton, currently the Mellon Assistant Professor of English and Creative Writing at Dartmouth. His book is Ode, and he speaks to the expansive range of registers within the world of Black aesthetics and experience the joy, the rage, the love, the terror, and awe that gives a world within a world all its shape and terror. He is a man who is extremely adept at creating images with his words. The book is Ode. Joshua, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim.
Appreciate it. Congratulations. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Until tomorrow, for Matt Doyle, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.